Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. today. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're broadcasting live from the Schwann Center here in Trago, Wisconsin, 2 hours north of the Twin Cities. There's a confessional Christian worldview seminar going on. It has been going on for almost a week, from Friday last week until Friday, 2 days from now. We will take your phone calls and your questions, your comments, during this last hour of the program at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If you've been listening off and on throughout the last 2 hours and haven't had an opportunity to call, we've been driving kind of in this direction for 2 hours, talking about the general cultural scene. We're going to turn to the realm of politics and look at the national political scene here during the last hour of the program today, live Wednesday, June the 25th, from the Marvin M. Schwamm Retreat Center here in Trago, Wisconsin. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So any question or comment you have of a political nature, this is the hour for you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Joining us for the last hour of the program, Professor Alan Quist. He's professor of political science at Bethany Lutheran College. He was the Republican-endorsed candidate for governor in Minnesota in 1994 and a former member of the Minnesota House of Representatives. Professor Quist, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, Todd, thank you so much for having me on.
Let's begin by assessing the big picture of this current presidency. Assess the first 2 years of George W. Bush's presidency for us, if you would.
Sure. Overall, on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the highest, I think I would be pretty aggressive, and I would probably rate his presidency at about an 8, something like that. At the time he was elected, I certainly hoped for less than that, and I would have rated him as a candidate probably closer to 6. But I think he has performed better, certainly better than my own expectations, and I think better than the expectations of most people.
What specifically changed not only your expectations but your assessment of this president from the time he was elected until now, basically midway through his term?
Clearly, it's been his foreign policy, and there's no question but what that has to be his reaction to the attack against our country that occurred on 9/11. Talk about putting a president in the hot seat to have terrorists attack our nation the way that they did. And if you want to put somebody, really test a president's mettle, is have your country be attacked unexpectedly, as was the case there. I'm of the conviction that his response has been extraordinarily strong, and I think his response has made Americans proud to be Americans. And I think that his response has, to a large degree, reestablished the proper prestige of the United States of America around the world.
George W. Bush ran as, and he didn't coin the term, but Marvin Alasky of World Magazine coined the term for him, I believe. He ran as a compassionate conservative. What did you understand that to be, and do you think he has kept that simple promise, that he would be what he calls a compassionate conservative?
You know, evaluation of rhetoric is always pretty interesting, and that's what you we're now into. Clearly, compassionate conservative was a campaign term, and it was one that apparently served the campaign well. The idea of being a compassionate conservative is, on the one hand, to be a conservative, and politically, nationwide, you get something like 40% of the populace that will say they're conservative and about 40% who will say that they are moderates and probably about 17% who say that they're liberals. So if you're conservative, politically, you're in a pretty good position. The typical attack on conservatives is you're mean. And, of course, many of us believe that that's not true, but that is the accusation. So the political strategy clearly was to try to be a conservative and make it difficult to be attacked as mean, heartless, cold. And taking a then-candidate, now president, who has a very warm smile, a very disarming way about him, the label given the persona of this president has worked pretty well.
Now, let's talk first about foreign policy, because you said that was really the clincher for you in your assessment of this president as well, beginning with probably the biggest foreign policy story still of today, the war with Iraq. How do you think that has – that was not the president's first reaction, of course, to September 11th. The first reaction was the action in Afghanistan. The war with Iraq followed rather shortly after that. How do you think that particular reaction to worldwide terrorism, the threat of weapons of mass destruction, has been carried out?
It's been carried out, first of all, on the idea level. And a big part of that is that prior to 9/11, let's suppose a presidential candidate had run for office saying, we're at risk of being attacked in a serious way by terrorists, and we have to start taking significant actions to counter that. My own guess is that the American public would have said, well, maybe, but, you know, I don't see that that's very high on the radar screen. And so what happened after the election versus what you could have run on were two very, very, very different things. But the fact of the matter is we were attacked, and the entire American mindset changed after 9/11. And part of that change was the realization that we have viewed ourselves as being really invulnerable for several decades, and all of a sudden we recognize, you know what, we are vulnerable, and national security, national defense are all of a sudden much, much higher priorities. And so what happened in a nutshell is, to take the old soccer mom type of terminology, if you ask the question, what's the soccer mom more concerned about, having enough money in the bank to send her kid to college, which is a high priority, or having her child be protected from terrorist attacks, all of a sudden protection became a higher issue. And clearly on the political side as well as the policy side, our president was able to step into that in a strong way and establish a lot of confidence and a lot of support, and a support base really politically that's very, very broad here in among the American public.
Part of the rationale that the president and his team put forward for pursuing military action in Iraq was, among other things, that there were in Iraq weapons of mass destruction, and that these weapons posed an imminent threat, or a near imminent threat, not only to the world but also to our nation. At this point in this war and its aftermath, there's been very little evidence of weapons of mass destruction, some of their production. And people are saying, if these weapons aren't found, this will be a major problem for this president. How important, how crucial is it that there be found in Iraq the weapons that the president talked about before the war?
I don't think it's nearly as crucial as the secular media makes it out to be. And the secular media is trying to paint the picture, along with political opponents who want to make political hay out of this, and that's understandable. It's not nearly as significant as they make it out to be. Number one, it's not as significant in the minds of the American public, because the American public has seen the incredible oppression of Saddam Hussein against his own people. I mean, here's somebody who has murdered, by conservative estimates, 300,000 of his own citizens just to protect his own power base, and has engaged in all kinds of atrocities. And so people love freedom, and when they see that we have been able to free the Iraqi people, that plays a very, very big role in the eyes of the American public. In addition to that, the secular media typically misrepresents the threat of Iraq to our country as it relates to weapons of mass destruction. Did President Bush conclude that Iraq probably had these weapons? Yes. Were they chemical weapons? Yes. Were they biological weapons? Yes. Were they nuclear weapons? There was a big question mark. Those weapons have not been found as of yet. But what we do know, and this is a big part of the story that the secular media never prints, is that what we do know is that when the Soviet Union collapsed, and I can't give you exact numbers, but it's hundreds of its nuclear weapons disappeared. And at this point in time, Russia and the former Soviet bloc countries cannot account for many of these these nuclear weapons. The Bush administration has very good reason to believe, and a lot of us have good reason to believe, that those weapons are out there on the black market someplace. You take a dictator like Saddam Hussein, who hates America, who sees himself as the reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar, and who wants to establish Iraq as a world power. Were he able to get his hands on those black market nuclear weapons, he would. And were he able to get his suicide fanatical individuals to in some way deliver those nuclear weapons against the United States or its allies, he would. Given that reality, there's no question in my mind but what our president made the right decision at the point in time that he made it.
So you're putting forth basically the position. We talked some time back with Michael Novak, and he said, look, we've got basically two ingredients sitting on a table. They're volatile in and of themselves, but put them together, and it's an immediate threat. That is the hatred of Saddam Hussein's regime for America in particular, and the possibility that he has or can get a hold of weapons to do us harm. Add to that a third ingredient, perhaps his willingness to work with terrorist organizations. And there's really no other choice.
There's really no other choice. And to put some detail on this, we did find Scud missiles in Iraq, and these were one of the contraband weapons that he said he did not have. The Scud missiles have the capability to deliver weapons from Iraq to Jerusalem. That weaponry was there. Okay, give Saddam Hussein the opportunity to buy a nuclear weapon on the black market. He's got the Scud missile to deliver that to Jerusalem. Can we afford to be in that kind of position? My answer and the answer of our president is we cannot.
Professor Alan Quist is our guest, professor of political science at Bethany Lutheran College. He was the Republican-endorsed candidate for governor in Minnesota in 1994 and a former member of the Minnesota House of Representatives. We're talking about the national political scene, foreign and domestic. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, feel free to do so. We are coming to you live Wednesday. It's the 25th of June. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So finally, you, on the issue of weapons of mass destruction, it is your opinion that the American people have really shifted their rationale for the war, even if we don't find weapons of mass destruction. It was worth it because the risk existed, and as a bonus, Iraq is free.
That's exactly right. And I don't think it's necessary to find those weapons because the public knows the history of Saddam Hussein. The public knows that he has had the weapons, that given the opportunity, he would get them again if he doesn't already have them. The record that he used those weapons against his own people, as well as against the Iranians, the Kurds, many of whom were within his own nation and so on. And so the American public really is quite astute. The American public looks at the whole picture, and the American public says, this president did the right thing.
Expanding our conversation to the Middle East, how has the toppling of Saddam Hussein's regime changed the balance of power and the political mix in the Middle East, especially with regard to our foreign policy?
The change is enormous, and let me compare it to the foreign policy of Bill Clinton. And of course, nobody expected George W. Bush's foreign policy to be exactly the same as his predecessor, but people didn't know how different it would be either. We, in fact, at this point in time, have a president who was willing to put the military might of the United States of America in play against a Mideast terrorist dictator that it concluded was a risk to the United States of America. Every country of the world, including every country in the Mideast, is going to take a very, very different perspective on the United States because of that. And when countries, including Iran, that begin to talk a little more conciliatory and begin to say, well, maybe we can make some progress here in working things out. A big part of that is because they recognize that the United States is willing to take action when necessary. And our president is of the mind, and I agree with him, that is a very, very positive position to be in.
With regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that the president is currently trying to apply most of his energies to, the roadmap for peace, could that have been achieved if Saddam Hussein, what has been achieved so far, if Saddam Hussein were still in power, still threatening our ally Israel, and still calling to arms the Palestinian people?
I don't believe so, because all sides are much more motivated to take the lead of the United States when they know that the United States is willing, should push come to shove, should all other alternatives fail, that the United States is willing to take pretty strong actions. Having said that, we do have to be realistic about the Mideast situation. And I am of the mind that our president, who has done very, very well, may have raised hopes too high with regards to a resolution of this dispute that is several millennia old. This is really, really, really tough, and it's not going to be solved quickly.
Let's talk a little bit about another part of the world with regard to our foreign policy, and that's South Korea. It has been a story that's been running concurrently with the Iraq story almost from the very beginning, almost from the very time that the president turned his military attentions toward Saddam Hussein. Kim Jong-il of South Korea has been saying, in effect, well, what about me? I'm a bad guy, too. He's been threatening to develop nuclear weapons. He said at times that he has them. He has been making a lot of noise. How much danger is there, and how much attention does this president need to pay attention to South Korea, North Korea?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to judge how much danger there is in North Korea. We do not have in North Korea the ongoing record of aggression in recent times, and I'm going to talk about the last 20 years, let's say. We don't have the ongoing record of aggression that you had in Saddam Hussein, so you don't anticipate that kind of belligerence in North Korea that we've seen on the part of Iraq. You also have a very peculiar situation where you've got a dictator, communist dictator, saying, look, I've got nuclear weapons. What's he up to? And there are many, and personally I'm one of them, who believes that here's somebody who wants to make a deal. And the bigger the prize, the more chips on the table. And he's saying, I've got some real big chips on the table here. The more chips on the table, the more perhaps somebody can get in return. So my estimation of it is that North Korea wants some food, some technology. North Korea is not going to survive as a nation. North Korea's population is in mass starvation, and the weapons they have been developed at the expense of the well-being of its people. It is not going to continue as is, and I think we've got a desperate dictator who is looking for some pretty big favors.
South Korea has been our ally since the conflict there in the late 50s, and we have had a military presence in the demilitarized zone, or at the demilitarized zone, between North and South Korea ever since the Korean conflict ended. A very strange turn of events took place about a week and a half ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, when we announced plans to withdraw our presence about 10, 15, 20 miles farther south from the demilitarized zone. And people were wondering, why are we doing this? Why now? Apparently it was something that the Clinton administration was also considering doing. What do you make of this, moving our troops farther south?
Well, it's clearly a conciliatory move on the part of our president as it relates to North Korea. And it's a statement. Militarily, it doesn't have a lot of significance, but politically it does. It's a statement that we're willing to give some, and we want to find a peaceful solution. We really don't want to settle this in military means, and there's good reason to believe that that's where North Korea is coming from anyway. So these things go in a step-by-step kind of process, and this is a step in the peace process, really, is what it is.
How does China figure into, because it is a proximate neighbor of North Korea, how does China figure into this whole North Korean conflict, or some people are even calling this the North Korean Cold War revisited?
It's a lot different than what we had back in the Korean War, because in the Korean War, clearly China and the Soviet Union were behind the North Korean aggression towards the South. That is not the case in the same way today. Today we've got a rogue nation that neither China nor Russia are supporting insofar as this military policy or the nuclear weapons policy is concerned. So it's pretty different. They're pretty much on their own. And again, it reinforces the view that they want to make a deal and they want to get something out of this. And I'll predict they will. We just don't know what, but they'll probably benefit.
Let's talk about the European relationship. It has been posited that this relationship with regard to Germany and France in particular and several others has been permanently damaged because of the president's insistence to go to war with Iraq. Germany and France were both not only hesitant, but they were actually resistant to the whole notion, especially in the forum of the UN. What do you make of this?
Well, let me concentrate on the UN part of it, which I think is very, I would say, exciting as well as gratifying, because the approach that our president has taken here, whether he was right or wrong, and I happen to think he was right, but regardless of that, the approach that he has taken is that the United States, as the world's only superpower, as the largest free people in the world, has to take the lead insofar as the big issues like dealing with a terrorist state, Iraq, is concerned. And the UN is not going to take the lead, and for that reason the U.S. Will. And so the role of our president was that we will take the lead if the UN rises to the occasion, which is very doubtful. Great. But if it doesn't, we will act as if the UN is irrelevant or ought to be, and we will assume our rightful leadership role. And that's what the United States did. France and Germany found themselves outside the mix. They found themselves, and by the way, neither one of them have any military power that amounts to a hill of beans. And so they can talk big, but they can't back it up. And so they were outsiders looking in. They want to pretend that they are, you know, have some significant military power in the world and some significant say, and they don't. But it's very hard for them to admit that they're pretty much irrelevant. They've made themselves to be irrelevant, as has the UN. And this is just facing reality. And I applaud our president on this in terms of taking the lead and putting the UN in the perspective that it deserves to be in.
When we come back, I'd like to pursue that a little bit more, if we could, the issue of the UN, especially what has happened to the UN that was founded as, well, it was founded as a League of Nations in order to promote peace, but it has in the past been willing to exert not only its own military power, but in cooperation with its member nations, military power in the world, I think only of the last Gulf War. What has changed in the UN? Whereas they were willing to take Saddam Hussein and dictators like him on militarily in the past, now seem unwilling and resistant to that. We'll talk about that when we come back. Professor Alan Quist is our guest, professor of political science at Bethany Lutheran College. He is also a former member of the Minnesota House of Representatives and a former Republican-endorsed candidate for governor in 1994. When we come back, we'll also turn our attention to domestic issues, the war on terror. Have we been asked to forfeit some of our civil rights in order to combat terror here and abroad? We'll talk about the life issues, tax cuts, and other domestic issues as well. What about this? What about this? This president has been typified lately as pulling kind of a Clinton-esque move, taking his opponent's issues off the table and using them for his own political advantage. We'll find out what our guest, Professor Alan Quist, thinks about that as we survey the national political scene here from the Malvern M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center in Trago, Wisconsin.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
How does a Christian behave ethically in the workplace when compromise and cutting corners seems to be the order of the day? Can a Christian behave ethically and still compete in the world of business? Christian Ethics in the Workplace by Ray Hilgert, Jim Truesdell, and Pastor Phil Lockus is our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. You can order the book online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. The workplace can be an ethical maze. Learn how to navigate it with our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. 1-800-325-3040.
Breakdown of the family. What's the solution?
Answers with Ken Ham.
a speaker at the very popular conference, Answers in Genesis. Well, Ken, why do you think the family unit is in such trouble today?
Well, the Bible teaches us that the family is the first and most fundamental of all human institutions which God ordained. He made the first family when he made the first man and the first woman, Adam and Eve, the first marriage. We're also told in the Bible that fathers are to be the spiritual head of their homes and are to communicate spiritual truths to their children. You see, the family is actually the educational unit which God uses to communicate his knowledge from one generation to the next and, of course, to the world around. Now, Satan knows if you destroy the family, you greatly weaken the backbone of the nation. You see, it's the educational unit that God uses to pass his truths on generation after generation after generation. Satan is very clever. He knows if you destroy the family, you'll basically destroy the nation. Surprisingly, one way the family is being destroyed is through the teaching of evolution. You see, if evolution's true, then the Genesis account of marriage, and thus the family, has no foundation. So therefore, marriage becomes whatever you want to make it to be. The more people believe in evolution, the more they'll reject marriage and the family, and that's exactly what we see happening in the culture.
Read Ken Ham's free booklet on races and racism when you log on to AnswersRadio.com. That's AnswersRadio.com.
AM 850 KFUO weather for St. Louis. Overnight cloudy, occasional showers and thunderstorms tonight. Low of about 66. For Thursday, cloudy, rain in the morning is likely and a high near 79. A bit cooler tomorrow. Right now, mostly cloudy and it's 90 in St. Louis. More on the national political scene with Professor Alan Quist and host Todd Wilkin live from Trago, Wisconsin, and the Schwann Center is next right here on AM 850 KFUO. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Westbound 40 after Hampton, heavy traffic to Hanley, also crowded west of 270 to Mason. Southbound 270 between Ladue Road and Doherty Ferry, there's some slow traffic there. Eastbound 270 between McDonald Boulevard and 170, the heavy traffic is there, so be careful. Eastbound 40 before Jefferson, heavy traffic to the Poplar Street Bridge, and northbound 55 between 44 and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane.
On the next special hour of Jubilation, I'll be sharing some thoughts with you about the hands of Jesus. How would you describe those hands? While they were hands that were nailed to a cross for your sins, Jesus' hands also performed other functions in service to the Heavenly Father. Hi, I'm Pastor Mark Hawkinson. Plan now to join me for the live special hour as I also take your requests and talk about the hands of Jesus. That's the special hour of Jubilation, Saturday at 4:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Twenty-five more minutes left in Issues, Etc. Today we're broadcasting live this Wednesday, June the 25th, from the Marvin M. Schwamm Retreat and Conference Center here in Trago, Wisconsin, 2 hours north of the Twin Cities, from a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar. You've been hearing us talk about this for, a couple months now. Here is the seminar, and we have one of the presenters with us here for the last 25 minutes, continuing a conversation started here in the third hour with Professor Alan Quist, talking about the national political scene. A lot of this that we've been talking about today has to do with the subject of this conference, Confessional Christian Worldview. Now, what is a worldview? A worldview informs a lot of things, not only your politics, not only your religion and how it relates to the culture, but also how you live out your everyday life in your vocation. And if it's in a place of business, as most vocations are, I want to recommend a book for you as we near the end of this month of June. It's our Issues, Etc. book of the month for June called Christian Ethics in the Workplace. It's written by a theologian, a businessman, and a professor at a business school. And through case study, it offers not only solutions, practical. By calling Concordia Publishing House tomorrow during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, call during regular business hours, or If you prefer, you can go online and order the book tonight at our website, issuesetc.org. That's issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section and you'll find information on Christian ethics in the workplace. The toll-free number again to call Concordia Publishing House tomorrow during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. I want to talk about where the president has dropped the ball to a certain extent, but there's a question hanging over from the last part of our conversation, Professor Quist, and that is, why has the UN, which seemed previously to be willing to go against dictatorships and to speak, not only speak out, but act against dictatorships, why have they been so unwilling to act against what appears to be kind of a black and white situation in Iraq?
Yeah. The history of the UN in terms of stepping in to try to stop conflict or deal with dictators is really not all that great. There are a few cases where the UN has acted, and certainly the most notable one recently was the first Gulf War, where Iraq attacked Kuwait and took over Kuwait. So you do have that kind of case where you have blatant aggression at a time when you had a little bit of a honeymoon between Russia and the United States, probably, where the UN was willing to take the lead. Again, the United States took the lead, and the UN in this case was willing to join in and basically say, me too. Usually cases aren't that clear cut. Usually the UN is unwilling to join in. And usually the U.S. is taking the leadership anyway. So I don't think it's that great a departure from what's typically been U.N. policy.
Let's turn our attention to the domestic front for this presidency and for the national political scene in general, and begin by saying, are there places there in the domestic front? You said before you were particularly pleased with the president's foreign policy. On domestic policy, are there places where you believe this president has either not fulfilled promises or dropped the ball?
Definitely, and I really believe his education policy is the most noteworthy area, and I'm speaking specifically about the No Child Left Behind federal education bill, which passed here about a year ago. The federal government has no business being in education. The 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution prohibits federal involvement in education. Education is one of the rights reserved for the states. And if the Constitution is not the highest law of the land, then we really are at the mercy of other people in government. So it's unconstitutional. In addition to that, it's just bad policy. Education takes place at the local level where parents, God willing, can make decisions, where teachers, God willing, can make decisions. And when you have bureaucrats and politicians from Washington making huge decisions on education policy, you've got a mega problem in addition to its being unconstitutional.
So you're really saying that the president has allowed through, by allowing No Child Left Behind to go through, you're saying that he has ignored a basic and fundamental mistake that we've made by turning the original intent of the Constitution with regard to education on its head. What used to be for the states now has become really a federal issue.
That's absolutely right. It's total encroachment of the federal government into what should be a decision made by parents, ultimately, and then to a lesser degree, state government officials. You know, the Constitution exists to protect the citizens, and the Constitution is set up so that it puts limits on government. That's what we are. We believe in limited government, and the reason for that is we believe that the citizens, especially the parents, ought to be making the big decisions. And the Constitution says to the government, thus far can you go and no farther. And when, in this case, the federal government blatantly violates that, then you don't have a check anymore on what government can do. And just one of the many consequences is that today parents are more likely to be asked to sign statements of supporting various things in education than they are in a position to do something about policy. Parents have become assistants to the schools rather than schools existing to assist parents. And that puts the purpose of schools relative to parents on its head, upside down, and that is largely a result of the federal takeover of education policy, which is unconstitutional.
President George W. Bush ran as a pro-life candidate. Abortion was something of an issue. It wasn't the hottest issue, although exit polling in 2000 did demonstrate that abortion was a large issue in the mind of many of the voters. How do you think he has done in the first half of his term with regard to the life issue?
Okay. Let me first mention there, Todd, that on the life issue as well as other issues, this president is turning out to be more conservative than would have seemed to be the case in his campaign. The life issue politically is something that people who are strongly pro-life find out about. They want to know, and it's a big issue in voting. And so you don't have to say much, and George W. didn't. You just have to say enough so that the pro-lifers know who's pro-life and who's not, and they're going to vote accordingly.
So they'll find out who the candidate is on their own.
That's right. And so to be low-key on that issue is not necessarily to say it's a low priority. And I think we're finding out that it's a much higher priority for the president than what he indicated in the campaign. And I would say the indication of that is not especially things like the partial birth abortion bill, which he's always supported and signed. The big issue is the issue of appointing judges to the courts, especially the Supreme Court. And the left, the abortion rights people, have no doubt in their minds that this president intends to appoint pro-life justices. And that's why they're being so obstructionist in confirming some of the lesser judges that the president has appointed.
Could it be that the abortion rights faction believes this president to be more pro-life than even pro-life voters believe him to be?
That's very possible. That's very possible. They are scared to death of his appointments, and I think they're right.
Let's take up that just very briefly. The president is, he has just one option left to him if he cannot get nominees through the Senate, and that is to do recess appointments, which then can be challenged, of course, later. He has had one after another pro-life judicial appointments to lower courts and to the mid-level courts tied up. Miguel Estrada, mm-hmm. and then there was another, the name escapes me, very recently a female appointee, through a stealth kind of a filibuster in the Senate. What do you expect of this president to do with regard to those judicial nominees?
Well, I think he will make the appointments when the Congress is not in session. And frankly, I think that that the abortion rights people have set the stage for this. To use the filibuster to block a president from making his chosen nominees to the courts is unprecedented in American government. It has never happened before. The filibuster has been reserved for other things, and it has always been recognized by both parties that a president has the right to appoint the people he wants, assuming good character, proper background. You know, in the case of Estrada, he's got the highest recommendation from the Bar Association. That's how outstanding his qualifications are. So when you've got unprecedented obstructionist tactics by the abortion rights people, this president is more than justified in making the appointments after Congress adjourns.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on the Bush presidency or any of the political hot-button issues we've been talking about, you can call us now, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Car phone callers, first-time callers, and Internet callers, of course, always get top priority. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. About 10 minutes left in this conversation with Professor Alan Quist, professor of political science at Bethany Lutheran College. He's a Republican-endorsed candidate for governor in 1994 in the state of Minnesota and a former member of the Minnesota House of Representatives. On the issue of fiscal policy, tax policy in particular, how would you assess this president's behavior and his performance so far?
On tax policy, I would give this president a score of 10 out of 10. It's just outstanding. And the reason that I say that in particular is because over the years, the tax burden has been shifted year by year, step by step, onto working, married families with children. And the president's tax cuts have targeted more than anything else married working families with kids, and that I applaud him for that priority. That's in addition to the stimulating the economy, putting money back in the taxpayers' hands, and all of those things. He is going overboard to start to put some justice into the tax system so that married people aren't carrying more load than they should.
Do you think he's been so aggressive with the tax cut policy because he understands that a lot of this could be undone in the future? I mean, if he throws enough spaghetti against the wall, some of it's going to stick, but a lot of it's going to fall off.
There are a couple things going on here. One is that the president got about half of the tax cut that he was asking for. That's probably about what he expected he was going to get. He's a very politically astute man. If you want a $500 billion tax cut, you ask for twice that, and you end up getting what you end up with. Secondly, I believe this president has outstanding political instincts, and he recognizes that the next time that the presidential election comes up, which is only a little more than a year away, if the economy is going strong, I mean, here's a president who's got a huge mandate. If the economy is not doing well, there's a potential problem. He's a Keynesian economics guy. He believes that if the economy is slow, you have to put money into the economy. It's theoretical. It's probably right, but that's the strategy.
Now, how do we reconcile that with the fact that with regard to especially legislation being passed and signed recently by this president, prescription drugs and things like that, government spending is bound to increase? How do we reconcile those two?
Yeah, that's part of the strategy, interestingly enough. We could take some time to talk about Keynesian strategy. By the way, John Fitzgerald Kennedy was the first president who was a Keynesian. The idea being you put money in the economy if the economy is slow. You do that by spending. And so one of the ironies here is you've got a president who believes you have to spend some money, in this case, let's say, prescription drugs, to stimulate the economy as well as the political mileage. At the same time, you have a tax cut. What's the downside? The downside is you increase the deficit. Do the voters care about the deficit? Not very much. So we'll see. It's high-stakes poker. Is he going to come out on top? I think he is. We'll know a lot more a year from now.
This raises, you talked about his political acumen, which I think probably everyone, friend and foe, critic and cheerleader, will recognize at this point that either he is being very well advised or he does have an amazing political ear and able to act upon it. In the last several weeks, popular commentators have been noticing that the president is pulling something of a Bill Clinton move, and that is to lay out his positions, allow his opponents to react to it with their own positions, then very deftly take his opponents' positions themselves and make them his own and act on them, therefore pulling a lot of opposition issues off the table, especially with a year or so to go before an election. Do you think that's true?
I think that's true, and I think that's smart politics. And prescription drugs, Medicare, are clearly prime examples. Bill Clinton, in spite of all of the things that I personally didn't like about him, was a very astute politician, very astute. And I think, you can borrow from the opponent's playbook anytime if it fits. And here I think it fits.
Does this president suffer any longer from being underestimated? Or benefit any longer from being underestimated?
I think he does, and I think that's a very ironic sort of thing to say, but I think he does, and the reason is because of the persona of this president, his public image. His persona is one of being firm but warm, concerned and strong, somebody who listens, but somebody who can be decisive. He has an amazing public image. And the number one thing, according to the polls, that people vote on when the rubber hits the road is they vote on image more than anything else. And this president has got it. But that image allows him to be underestimated because he doesn't overpower you. He's really easy to like, or at least the image is really easy to like.
Let's go to the phones as our conversation winds down. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Herman is on the line calling from Illinois. Herman, thank you for waiting and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to say I've appreciated the insights of your guest. I think it's been a welcome perspective that he has given this evening, and I would like to ask from his experience and knowledge, how would he appraise the future of Bill and Hillary Clinton? Are they people who are more or less trying to project a future being more or less mesmerized by their own vanity and in that sort of vein? Do they have a serious future in American political life?
Herman, thank you very much for the call and the question. Your assessment there of the former president and former first lady.
Well, maybe we should refer to them as the dynamic duo. They're both political animals and very, very different people, but both very politically astute. If you want the long and short of it, Bill Clinton is campaigning to be the next Secretary General of the United Nations. He already has a half a dozen third world countries supporting him. You want to know where he's trying to go? That's where he's trying to go. Hillary Clinton has her new book out. Clearly, that's a PR effort on her part. Does she want to be president? She wants to be anything, and president, you bet. She's going for it.
Speaking of first ladies, this first lady, Laura Bush, has been, by comparison with previous first ladies, going back some time, really. Not only Hillary Clinton, but Barbara Bush, and before that, Nancy Reagan, and before that, others. She has been remarkably low-key and out of the scenes. What do you think the American people, how do you think they assess her and her role there in the White House?
I think they're very comfortable with Mrs. Bush. And, of course, you know, keep in mind what she's following. She's following an act where everybody joked about Hillary being the president, you know, as the president and her husband. And so in that setting, I think there's a lot of political mileage in a president's wife who is willing to stay in the background and probably play, it's more of a traditional Mamie Eisenhower type of role, and the public is real happy with that.
We are headed toward presidential elections here. The Democratic field of candidates will be narrowed doubtlessly in the primaries, but at this point it's almost like watching the front line of a football team. How do you expect that to shake out as the president and his opponents go into the primaries for 2004?
There are so many resources, it's tough to judge. I'll have to say I think that Gebhardt is probably a pretty good has got to be one of the leading contenders. And I say that simply because of his public personality. He looks good. He's kind of warm. And I don't want to be derogatory about voters, but, hey, the polls always show that image, if you're warm and smile and kind of seem kind of harmless, that sells pretty well. The fact of the matter is, though, we don't have any superstars. And it reminds me of all the way back when George Bush Sr. was president, and Bill Clinton was one of the contenders, and I always felt that Bill Clinton was a superstar in terms of being politically savvy, and in terms of creating a good public image, being able to speak, answer to questions, respond to the press. And I felt all the time that Bill Clinton would give George Bush Sr. real trouble. We don't have that kind of Democratic candidate today.
We talked before about the shortcomings of this president and his policies, his presidency. You mentioned the education policy. Are there any other things that come to mind where you would say, okay, I was going to rate him a 6, and now I'm rating him an 8, as you said at the beginning of our conversation, but what's keeping him from a 10, those 2 points? Is it only education policy?
That's correct. It's only education policy, in terms of major issues. And I think that's because he has the wrong people around him on that issue, and I'm hopeful that he will get some better advisors on that, can straighten that area out. In the other areas, this guy is continuing to hit home runs.
You mentioned several times here in this conversation image. Image is largely measured not only by what someone feels when they look into a TV screen and the president's there talking, but also by how they answer questions polling the next day. He's had strong numbers, this president has. Does it make him undefeatable in 2004? Are there mistakes that he could make that could forfeit the kind of strong presidency that you portrayed for us during this conversation?
There certainly are mistakes. Plus, there may be things out of his control. You know, if the economy really goes south and the federal government is in a position where it can influence the economy, but it certainly can't control the economy. And who knows what might happen in the world seen out of his control. So always, I mean, if you're in office, you take the blame for something that happens, whether you can control it or not. But on that and on the image issue, I would like to at least mention the fact that we have a president here who is a confessing Christian. And I'm not in a position to judge his heart. Everything that I see suggests to me that he is sincere. But regardless of that, he is a confessing Christian. And as an observer of politics and as an observer of people in office, I am convinced that that makes a significant difference in how he proceeds. If you ask the question, for instance, do you see any signs of arrogance in President George W. Bush, I think most people are going to say no. I mean, I don't see any signs of arrogance. Do you see any signs of weakness? No. Is he decisive? Yes. Is he principled? Yes. Is he warm? Yes. Does he seem to have a real heart for all kinds of people? He does. Here is somebody whose persona, at least, corresponds to the image of what you would expect in a Christian statesman. And I think that that is worth at least observing.
With only 1 minute and no more before we have to wrap up this conversation, given what you've seen so far of the Bush presidency, how do you believe he will be judged by history as a president of the United States? What will be the assessment?
It is so difficult to say, but at this point in time, he will be judged as the person who reestablished the position of the United States of America as the world leader in the struggle, ongoing struggle for freedom, for every individual, and respect and human dignity, as opposed to allowing the UN sit back and twiddle its thumbs. And that legacy is an extraordinarily commendable legacy.
Professor Alan Quist, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Professor Alan Quist is professor of political science at Bethany Lutheran College. He's a Republican-endorsed candidate for governor in the state of Minnesota in 1994 and a former member of the Minnesota House of Representatives. Tune in tomorrow to Issues Etc. We're going to continue broadcasting live Thursday, tomorrow, from the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center as they host a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar. Craig Parton will be among our guests tomorrow. He'll be one of the presenters. We'll talk about apologetics. I'd like to thank my guests during these 3 hours as we've been up here in Trago, Wisconsin. In the first hour, we had State Senator Michelle Bachmann, and we talked about postmodernism and education. Also in the second hour, Dr. Angus Manoj, and our guest during this hour, Professor Alan Quist. Thanks to all of them. Tune in tomorrow to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.